The Guardian.
Boris Johnson launches Project Speed as Leicester grinds to a halt. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
This moment also gives us a much greater chance to be radical and to do things differently, to build back better and to build back bolder. And so we will be doubling down on our strategy. We will double down on levelling up, if you can make sense of that.
On Tuesday, political commentators spent the afternoon trying to make sense of what the Prime Minister called a New Deal for Britain. Speaking at Dudley's Institute of Technology, Johnson claimed to be channeling Franklin Roosevelt as he promised to speed up campaign promises to spend on infrastructure, with an added pledge not to impose spending cuts elsewhere anytime soon. The Prime Minister might have hoped that his speech, coupled with the scheduled reopening of most of England's economy on Saturday, would give a much-needed lift to the nation's spirits. But a spike in coronavirus cases in the city of Leicester saw the government enforce the country's first local lockdown, a move they would surely have wanted to avoid at the very moment they were hailing Britain to be open once more. So is the government trying to shift the focus away from the pandemic by talking of the post-coronavirus rebuild with big promises to flash the cash? And will the reality match Johnson's rhetoric? We'll discuss it. Also, the mayor of Leicester was quick to rebuke Downing Street for what he described as a lack of communication and data from the government when making the decision to keep the city in lockdown. So how should local councils prepare for a second wave? And how should the government help them plan for that possibility? Later, I'll be speaking to two councillors from Leeds and Hertfordshire, one from each of the two main UK parties, about this very issue. Plus, The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Wintour, updates us on the latest reports of infighting in the Commonwealth and why Britain might be forced to re-evaluate the future of that network of nations. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, despite a second wave, if we can call it that, hitting Leicester before the latest lifting of lockdown measures could be implemented, Boris Johnson was outselling what he called, in the language of the Depression-era American president, a New Deal. The critics were, of course, quick to poke holes in his renewed package aimed at levelling up the country after the COVID-19 crisis. To discuss that and much more, I'm joined by my colleague, who's a columnist for The Guardian and chief leader writer for The Observer, Sonia Soda. Sonia, lovely to have you on the programme. This week began with hard hats and high-vis jackets, which I think gave all of us painful flashbacks of the December election campaign. Our colleague, Raphael Baer, called Boris Johnson's proposed New Deal a hollow distraction in his column on Tuesday. Is this all part of a move to get us looking elsewhere to distract us from coronavirus crisis, even though the virus itself is still very much with us?
Well, I think if we were being generous to the government, we'd acknowledge that ministers are really worried about the economic impact of the pandemic and are sort of scratching their heads thinking about what they can do to kind of minimise the long-term economic damage. But I do think that if you look at the content of Boris Johnson's speech, I very much agree with Raphael Baer. It felt more sort of about a branding exercise and sort of going back to some of those really bombastic positive messages we saw in the general election campaign at the end of last year than actual real substance. And I think if you look at the detail, there were a lot of pots of money that were simply re-announced. Now, it's not necessarily a bad thing to bring announced spending forward a bit in the time of a pandemic, I suppose. But a lot of those sums were really quite marginal. We're talking about something like, you know, £200 million for further education. And I think given that this was briefed as a sort of Rooseveltian New Deal, when you compare the size of what the government announced this week to what someone like, you know, Roosevelt was doing in the wake of the Great Depression, there just is no comparison in terms of the size. And the package that the government announced, I think, really does feel quite incremental. And you know, I think there was a lot of disappointment out there that this doesn't really go quite far enough.
I mean, you're at this point about scale, I think our colleague Marina Hyde captured it nicely when saying it's not exactly the Hoover Dam. He might just about run to a Hoover. And it does feel like that a bit. It is dwarfed in terms of scale. But I suppose he would say he got the spirit of it. In Prime Minister's Questions, which has just finished as you and I now talk, the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, pressing in a way the same point about this not being sufficient, asked what this so-called New Deal will do for jobs, that, and especially those jobs that are expected to be lost once the Chancellor's furlough scheme ends. And the Prime Minister's answer was just to repeat the same mantra again, build, 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 and jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, it sounds fairly sort of musical when you hear it put like that, but is that good enough, do you think?
No. And I think this is something that Labour, as you say, have picked up on, but also a lot of the economic think tanks working in this area have also pointed out is a flaw in the plan. I think personally that that some jobs are going to disappear and they're just not going to come back. So I think the pandemic is going to accelerate the decline of the high street, for example, and some aspects of British retail and some aspects of the British service sector. And what we know from past recessions is when jobs disappear, often new jobs do appear as economic recovery starts, but they're not the same sort of job. So you really have to invest a lot into retraining and reskilling people. And that is something that we really did not get right out coming out of the economic recession of the 1980s. And it's why lots of people who used to work in manufacturing literally found themselves on the job scrap heap for 20, 30 years claiming benefits because they just weren't invested in terms of reskilling and retraining. And there's been very, very little from the government on that. I think there's been far too little on young people, and we've heard very little from the government beyond, you know, a sort of headline apprenticeship guarantee for what it's going to do for those young people. So I think that was something that was really, really missing from this week's plan.
What about this very particular focus Boris Johnson wants to have on building, build, 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 casting himself as the great sort of construction impresario? And obviously one of the obstacles that as he would describe it, is the issue of planning. And he says he wants to tackle that. It was one of his great unresolved challenges of the last three decades, as he put it. Developers are obviously, that's going to be music to their ears, the notion that there will be fewer obstacles in their way. But will it change how many actual houses are built in the long term, this new shift by Boris Johnson?
I'm sceptical. We've seen governments over the last few decades talk about how they're going to relax planning in order to unleash a new wave of house building. And it's not really something that's ever come to fruition. And I think that's because when you look at why more houses aren't getting built, planning is part of the issue, sure, but it's a small part of it. And there are other really big issues that are sort of clogging up the housing market. For example, the fact that there are huge financial incentives for landowners and developers to kind of sit on land and keep it empty in order to inflate prices, for example. And unless you really sort of tackle those core structural issues, you're not going to tackle the house building crisis fully, I think. And you can see why a Conservative government has gone for planning. It fits with, you know, its ideological sort of bent, which is really around reducing regulation, cutting red tape. But by putting all his eggs in the planning basket, there is a real risk attached to this, which housing charities like Shelter have raised, for example, which is if you relax planning regulations, what you can start to see is homes being built that just aren't really, they don't meet a decent home standard. So I don't think it's going to be one that sort of gets us very far as a country.
Now, we need to talk about and focus on Leicester, because the government wanted this week to be all about a return to normality, emerging from hibernation. And instead, much of the news this week has been about the local lockdown necessary for large parts of Leicester due to an outbreak of coronavirus there. That is against the background of still the government not really having a firm grip on track and trace. To what extent is this government ready for local lockdowns like the one we're now seeing in Leicester?
Well, I think actually Leicester as a case study is really worrying, and it poses all sorts of serious questions for the government's pandemic strategy. First of all, there was this idea that the 4th of July, US Independence Day, was touted weeks ago as the big relaxation, the big reopening of the British economy, and suddenly, hey presto, it's all fallen into place, even though the government couldn't know what would be happening with infection rates at this time.
So it was cart before horse.
Exactly. And, I think that's why we've seen some very senior prominent scientists like Sir David King really questioning whether this is the right time to be going for such a big relaxation, relaxing so many things at once. So that is happening while we're seeing spikes. And it's not just Leicester that people are pointing to. It's, as we've reported in The Guardian this week, it's other areas, including in the Northwest, some areas of West London. Now, if you've got a test, track and trace scheme acting really well in the community, what that should mean is you literally see a local spike, hyperlocal spike, as it's happening. You're able to identify the factory or the school and take action to trace, and if you need it, have a very hyperlocal lockdown by shutting a very small part of the economy, or perhaps getting three or four streets to lock down. Now, what seems to have happened is that just didn't take place, and so 3 weeks later you're having to shut down a whole city and its urban area, which affects so many more people. So why wasn't this done more quickly? And it sounds like not only is track and trace not working properly, but the government hasn't even got the basic data right. So this week we've learned that the only data that's public is actually quite a small slice of the tests, the positive tests that are going on. So for example, Leicester Council thought that there wasn't a problem, when actually the government's data, which it didn't share with the council, according to the mayor, suggests that there was a big problem sort of building up over the last 2 or 3 weeks. So it's really worrying. It suggests that the government's data systems just aren't good enough yet to track kind of these local spikes quickly enough in order to avoid the need for kind of quite big, we call them local lockdowns, but this is locking down a whole city. And that is going to be really, really problematic, I think, when it comes to outbreaks and a second wave. I think these are the areas where you're going to start to see second waves happen.
On your first point there, Sonia, I'm very much reminded of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, who on this podcast was telling us weeks ago that he and his fellow mayors around the country were crying out for more local and regional data so they could plan and they could know what was happening in their areas. And in a way, what's happened in Leicester has vindicated all that. Now, we should talk about Labour. They managed to make some of the news last week, for at least for 48 hours, with the sacking by Keir Starmer of his Shadow Education Secretary, Rebecca Long-Bailey, after she had refused to delete a tweet, tweeting out an article that had included a false claim about Israeli forces training United States police in the knee-on-neck technique that killed George Floyd in Minneapolis. Since then, Rebecca Long-Bailey's written a piece, actually, in The Guardian, explaining things from her point of view, and she has actually deleted the two original tweets just in the last day or so. That sacking by Keir Starmer did have a big impact. Seemed as if Keir Starmer was making good on his promise of zero tolerance of anti-Semitism. What did you make of it?
I sort of thought it was a bit of a no-brainer for Keir Starmer, actually, to act in the way that he did. I think it was a morally right thing to do. And I think he was able to sort of show a clear signal that, as you say, Johnny, he was serious about taking action on anti-Semitism. But I also think it sort of played a double purpose for him. So as well as doing that, it also gave him the opportunity to sort of stamp his authority and his mark on the party and say, look, I'm not going to tolerate this sort of behaviour from the left of the party. And it's my party now. I've got the authority. I'm not going to sort of make moral compromises on these things. I'm going to take a strong stand. And I think it gave a very strong signal.
But this, a lot of people contrasting this zero tolerance stance of Keir Starmer's with his forgiveness, as it were, of the Labour MP Lloyd Russell Moyle, who had accused J.K. Rowling of using her experience of domestic violence as a tool or a sort of cudgel against trans people. And Starmer accepted Russell Moyle's apology. Is there a difference there between those two approaches? And if there is, why do you think Keir Starmer chose to react to these two different episodes differently?
I think there is a bit of a difference, although we are sort of talking about different things. And I think, you know, obviously there's anti-Semitism and racism, and then this is an example of misogyny. And I do think Lloyd Russell Moyle was, I thought his comments were really disgusting about J.K. Rowling, and I do think it was potentially sackable.
Sonia Soda, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Now, to hear from someone completely different.
Of course, our association is more than a partnership of governments. The real soul of the Commonwealth, the motor, the drive, call it what you will, is provided by people within and without those governments.
The voice of the Queen talking about the Commonwealth, an organisation which evolved out of what was the British Empire and is now an association of 54 different nations. It tries to operate via consensus and bills itself as a network of nations that share a common history. But sometimes that consensus breaks down. Last month, there were reports of indignation from leaders of some countries at Boris Johnson's alleged role as chair of the Commonwealth to intervene in the reappointment of that organisation's Secretary General. In this report, The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Wintour, explains what caused the rift and why commentators are warning that Britain and the Commonwealth itself may have to reevaluate the role of the organisation in the years ahead.
May I just put on record my thanks for the support my home country of Dominica, along with others from the Caribbean, gave me at the start of the long journey.
Baroness Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth, and she is a former Labour peer. She was an Attorney General under Gordon Brown and a seasoned, weighty politician, but she's been controversial as the head of this body. The chief reason is that there's been complaints about the way in which she has distributed contracts within the organisation, that there hasn't been a proper competitive tendering process, and that some of the beneficiaries of these contracts have emerged to be people who are either personally or politically close to her. And there's been a view also that she has been profligate in the spending on her offices. I think the predominant reason is the sense there's been overspending and proper procedures were not followed.
The Home Secretary is doing an outstanding job. I have every confidence in her.
I think he followed the instincts of every father and every parent. And I do not mark him down for that.
But I wonder whether, if you look at how the Conservative Party tends to gather around the tribe when one of their own are in difficulties about alleged corruption, whether she would have not got more defence from Downing Street if she had been a Conservative peer. Normally, the Secretary General for the Commonwealth serves a renewable four-year term and they can only serve two terms. And Baroness Scotland's contract was coming up after her first term for renewal in June. Boris Johnson, Prime Minister and current chair of the Commonwealth rotating post, had sent a note to all the Commonwealth nations saying there was not a consensus behind renewing her contract. There was a dispute within the Commonwealth about how this process of deciding whether she should have a new contract was being handled. And the Secretary General's supporters felt a minority of nations was going to try and effectively eject her as Secretary General, and that there was majority support for her. And the problem in all this is that the Commonwealth tries to operate through consensus and not voting. So it was very unclear where the majority view lay. Baroness Scotland Up organised a virtual meeting for last week, and there was some pushback on this for some time from Downing Street, saying they weren't clear what the purpose of the meeting was, what was the agenda. I think in that in itself was quite controversial because if you look at any kind of multilateral institution in the middle of this kind of pandemic, they have tried to meet and discuss the implications. And it seemed equally strange for the UK to be trying to prevent the Commonwealth meeting collectively to discuss the impact of the pandemic on some of these very poor countries, countries that in the Caribbean and in Africa need a lot of help with debt. So there was an argument about whether the meeting should happen and what the agenda was. And behind all that was probably also a concern that Baroness Scotland was trying to forced Number 10 into giving her a second four-year term. Barry Scotland ended up with a kind of compromise in which it's been agreed that she will remain in post until there is a, at least until there's a heads of government summit. That was due to happen this month in Rwanda, and it's been delayed probably until next June. So I think she's in probably safe for at least another 12 months. And it's really unclear whether Number 10 has an alternative candidate that they're going to push and whether they could ever get majority support for that. Number 10 also has to tread carefully because I don't think Buckingham Palace will want a massive row about who should be the next head of the Secretariat.
Still, though, there's speculation about who will succeed the Queen as head of the Commonwealth, a matter, it seems, for member states.
There is a view that when the monarch dies, because she has been head of the Commonwealth for so many years, we're talking decades and decades, it will require a re-examination of the role of the Commonwealth. I mean, its supporters say that it is a kind of one of the least obnoxious international institutions in the world. In fact, it's a very effective form of networking, and it brings together countries that basically have an ethos of democracy and of parliament and a common history. There is a purpose to it, even though it's obviously not a decision-making body. But with the loss of Queen Elizabeth, it will certainly be a moment when the Commonwealth will have to review its role and think what it's doing. There is a danger also that with the UK running this global Britain strategy post-Brexit, that the Commonwealth ends up being used as a means for the UK to seek out new trade markets. And in effect, it becomes a substrata of the Foreign Office rather than being an independent body with a life of its own.
The Guardian's Patrick Wintle. To clarify, Baroness Scotland denies accusations that she circumvented normal competitive tendering processes, including the time when she awarded a lucrative consultancy contract to a company run by a friend. After the break, I speak to two councillors worried about the long-term effects the COVID-19 crisis will have on their councils and areas. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, Boris Johnson had a spring in his step when he made his speech in Dudley this week, announcing that his government was going to spend big to get Britain back on its feet post-pandemic. During the speech, he remarked that it's important to set out the government's intentions so that everyone can think and plan for the future. Well, in the last few weeks, local councillors around England have been doing a lot of planning and some serious worrying about the future, particularly when it comes to balancing their books in the next few years. Local councillors look on anxiously at the city of Leicester, now locked down once again, all the while wondering if they are prepared for a second wave to hit their area should the worst happen. And many councillors are hoping that Westminster will include the needs of local councils as part of this new deal to build. I wanted to hear from local government officials on the ground, so at the start of the week, I spoke to James Lewis, who's a Labour councillor for the Kippax and Methley ward in Leeds, and with David Williams, the Conservative leader of Hertfordshire County Council, who also chairs the County Council Network. Councillors, it's very good to have you both on the programme. Thank you so much. I think what would be great, first of all, is to hear very directly from both of you about the specific impact coronavirus has had on the councils where you serve. And why don't we start with you, Councillor James Lewis?
The impact we've seen on coronavirus has been enormous in terms of the impact of lockdown, the impact of people who have been furloughed and out of work and maybe not going back to work at the end of it. And also we've seen a huge impact on our council budget. Some of that has been the extra costs of supporting services through the COVID-19 crisis. So that was things like extra PPE for our staff that have been out working on the front line. It's been extra money for our providers in children and adult social care. But we've also seen the council's income drop, whether that's some of our local taxation. So our council tax receipts have gone down and business rates collection has gone down. But also the things that people pay to use council services that after a decade of austerity have actually now more and more cover the cost of council services directly. So we lose over £1 million a month just with having our sports centres closing. That's just one thing. We've seen the same with some of our city centre parking, some of our providing school dinners has been a loss of income. So overall, we've seen a loss of about £200 million predicted due to COVID, and that's out of a budget of just over £500 million for the year.
So like James, we've thrown the kitchen sink, candidly, at adult social care and also our children's services, and we've made a lot of commitments to the local providers. And as a consequence, we see public health as being a real challenge for us. We've been supporting the shielding program that the government has introduced. So as we look at the situation now, we're looking at pressures of something like £78 million, largely in terms of COVID costs. And where my situation differs from James's is that we operate in a two-tier area. So we support our 1.2 million population with adult social care and with children's services and with public health. But we don't have those income generating services such as parking, leisure centres. Those are the responsibility in a two-tier area of our district and borough councils. So big numbers. My budget is £860 million a year, so it's a significant proportion of that. But we don't have the same income challenges that James has got.
And in that context, there has been a lot of talk about the fact there is variation across the country and whether in some ways there needs to be more of a kind of tailored response. And what I've got in mind there is that very local lockdown in Leicester, because there's been an uptick of coronavirus there. My colleague Amy Walker reported on Monday that Sir Peter Soulsby, the mayor of Leicester, has found that the government's lack of communication there, in his words, is intensely frustrating because they don't have the very specific local information they need. How have you found, beyond the questions of resources, information you're getting from central government, and particularly that kind of bespoke, localised information that would enable you to marshal a very local response? Why don't we start with you in Hertfordshire, David Williams?
Yes, I mean, communication has been a challenge. I have to say, you know, there's been an unprecedented amount of contact with government departments, with the local government association, and we're all now, you know, on weekly Zoom or Teams calls. But going back through the crisis, in terms of PPE, in terms of shielding, in terms of testing, there have been some real challenges. So there have been some undoubted frustrations, but we are coming through it. We're addressing them. You know, we're working very hard to make sure that we deliver well for our residents. The latest issue is the whole question of outbreak control as we move into this next phase. And the wheels have been spinning a little bit. We have been provided with funding to do this, but we just need to get the arrangements in place, the resources on the ground. But the issues in Leicester are the first we've seen on a particular scale.
What we're struggling with now, as we think we've got the virus under control more at a national level, but we still have the local outbreaks, is actually that very quick access to all the data that's being generated by the various different agencies and organisations involved. I think that's where the new challenge will come, is very quickly being able to identify where local outbreaks are, to trace the source of that and make sure people are able to be tested and then respond accordingly.
David Williams, I'm guessing that people in your position, the thing you fear most is a second wave. If that came and you had to organise a second lockdown, whether just on your own locally or as part of a national one, are you equipped? Are you ready for a return to full lockdown if it comes?
We'll take whatever steps are necessary, Jonathan, but it would be a huge challenge again. And, you know, how the public will respond to a second lockdown is, I think, a challenging question.
That sounds like you think they would react very badly if it came.
I suspect so, yeah. You know, it's been really tough. We've seen now the reactions as we've come out of lockdown, and obviously some concerns about the behaviour of some people around the country, I envisage it would be really difficult. And then, you know, the whole question then of commerce and the hospitality sector, the travel sector, all of those issues which we've understood and seen those businesses beginning to get their head above the parapet, thinking about how they're going to come out of lockdown, to go back again would be catastrophic.
Catastrophic. And James, Lewis, I mean, we're hearing that the biggest issue beyond all the sort of psychological stuff about whether people could just emotionally cope with going back on lockdown is, it would be, as we just heard there, catastrophic economically. And local councils have been saying that they're desperately worried, in particular about adult social care services. My colleague Patrick Butler reported last week that, according to work, a study, 8 out of 10 English councils that provide adult social care services are currently at risk of bankruptcy. I mean, is, you know, given that if there's no money coming in and you've got to provide this resource, are you and your colleagues sitting around there worried that if a second wave comes, you too could go bankrupt?
I think the challenge we face is twofold. I think, first of all, before the COVID-19 pandemic started, we were in a position where we were over 60% of our budget is spent on adult and children's social care as a council. Everything else that people think the council provides, whether it's parks, libraries, emptying the bins, sweeping the streets, is squeezed into that other 40%. Without COVID, that share that went on social care compared to other services was going to get bigger. We thought it would get closer to 75%. So adult social care in particular is the area that could bankrupt a council, in terms of it being the only area where we resource and everything else is squeezed into that ever smaller share of the council budget that services are funded from. And that's where we'd have to keep cutting services in order to maintain a budget. That's been the challenge around adult social care. I think the challenge around a second wave is, if it is of the scale of the closures we saw in March and April, I think that'd have a devastating effect on businesses.
I know it's hard to put a figure on it. Maybe it isn't a figure, but in a nutshell, what is your ask of the government? What do you need from them? And it may be just literally a sum of money, but start with you, Councillor Lewis.
I think if we were asking for a sum of money, we think we've got a funding gap of around £150 million that needs filling. And there are things that actually the government could do to help us. It may not just be writing us a cheque, but it could be things, for example, at local councils, we have to balance our revenue budgets in each financial year. If we recognise that this pandemic was a historic event and we said, actually, councils can balance their budgets over the next 3 years or over the next 5 years, that would take some of the immediate pressure off for us to reduce services we provide in order to meet the costs of COVID.
That's really interesting. David Williams, similar demand, different figure?
Well, different figures and real demands, but I do believe that the government gets it. So, you know, going back a couple of years, they made available £650 million to us, and then in the spending round in 2019, they made available $1.5 billion to us. And as we've gone into the crisis, we've had two tranches of funding so far, totaling £3.2 billion. And we're imminently, as far as I'm aware, going to get a further announcement on meeting the requirements for the next few months. And importantly, particularly for a council like James's, finding a way to tackle the income conundrum. You know, how do we fund Leeds City Council for its lost parking revenues or any investments that it's got? There's a huge conundrum there, and government hasn't really been able to address that income question. But I'm confident it's about to, and that's going to involve some sort of guaranteed commitment to all councils in terms of how irrecoverable income will be compensated for.
I mean, just on the money for a moment, because your different experiences are relevant here. That study I referred to a moment or two ago found that the most deprived areas of England, often Labour-represented areas, had already been hit hardest by a decade of austerity policies since 2010. Conservative voting areas had tended to be insulated from the most severe of those cuts. To you, Councillor Lewis, do you think that's right, that Labour areas, inner city areas, you know, areas that started poorer to start with, have they been treated more harshly financially? And if so, is there some extra thing that the government should do to protect those areas from, you know, falling off a cliff as these expenses rack up?
I think part of the part of what we're seeing with the COVID-19 challenge for council finance is actually an acceleration of trends that have been developing since austerity started. So it's those northern authorities that have a weaker council tax base, had a greater reliance of government on government grant in the first place, which has been withdrawn quicker due to austerity, and have less external income generating opportunities. Those trends have been very prevalent during austerity, and we're just seeing the COVID crisis accelerate those.
And do you think that's fair, Councillor Williams? Have you been, as a Tory council, a bit insulated from the worst effects of the last 10 years?
I'd argue not, Jonathan. Much of those grants, that grant funding that I talked about that's been provided to local government over the last 3 years, it's all been distributed using a formula that takes account of deprivation, rurality, demography. And that's a very important way in which funding is passed on to those most deprived areas. However, you know, all that James said in terms of some of the economic challenges that coastal towns, some market towns, some old industrial towns and cities have faced, I don't want to in any way deny that those areas face some enormous economic challenges. But nevertheless, let's remember that much of the grant funding that's been allocated in recent years has got a deprivation element to it. Maybe that could be fine-tuned, but nevertheless, there is a principle there that this money is handed out and provided to the areas that need it most.
Let's just talk about something which isn't immediately in your own backyard, but I think may have a resonance for you. And this was the this is the case of the housing minister, Robert Jenrick, and he's got himself in trouble over the overruling he made of a planning decision, particularly in terms of the timing of it, so that it was in time for a developer to avoid paying tens of millions that he would have had to pay in duties and taxes that would have gone to the Tower Hamlets Council. And instead, Jenrick made the decision in such a way that the developer, Richard Desmond, was let off that charge. Obviously, that money would have been absolutely precious to that council. I'm just wondering what your perspective was as councillor sitting in different places, whether you looked at that and thought, well, God, that would be awful if the Secretary of State intervened in a local planning case for you that saw you lose 40-odd million pounds. Start with you, Councillor Lewis.
I think we've all faced a challenge of a need for more houses in our areas, but along with new houses, we need to provide extra facilities, whether it's schools, roads, public transport. I think what this issue down in Tower Hamlets has shown is actually just how hard developers fight back about making a contribution to communities that they make money out of as developers. And as we've talked about already, our ability to fund local services reduced as we've seen the amount of money available to local councils reduced. These what might seem additional sources of income are actually vital to doing one of the big things we have to do as local councils, which is putting in the infrastructure in place to support our local residents.
And Councillor Williams, you'd have been pretty annoyed, wouldn't you, if the Secretary of State, whoever it was, whichever party, had intervened in a local planning issue that ended up, because of the rules, depriving you and your fellow councillors and, in fact, local ratepayers of tens of millions of pounds.
Absolutely. Planning obligations, as they're called, are absolutely essential to enable us, as James said, to deliver the infrastructure that we need. And these community infrastructure levy arrangements are only set up after having gone through due process. So, yeah, I would not have been a happy bunny if I'd lost out on a contribution like that that was proposed in Tower Hamlets.
Do you get the sense from your constituents that if extra money does not come from central government and you are forced to cut almost every other service in order to keep going with adult social care, that we will be looking at huge anger in your local electorates by the time that you're, you know, either the next general election, but also when you as councillors are next up for election? Is something big coming politically, given how big the pandemic has been and the economic impact of it?
I mean, let me start, Jonathan. You know, one of the things that James was talking about was if as a council you can't make ends meet and balance your budget, there is a legal obligation to effectively liquidate the council. It's called a Section 114 arrangement. That would be devastating. So there would be a huge backlash, I'm absolutely sure. However, I do go back to the point that I do think the government gets it. it has provided us with a lot of money so far. You know, inevitably, the gold standard here would be to go back and have a three-year spending review, understand the envelope for local government, and then have fair ways in which that funding could be distributed. It's not happened because of Brexit. It didn't happen because of the election. And obviously now we've got the COVID crisis. But I do think that the government gets it. And I'm pretty sure, I'm pretty confident that even as early as this week, we'll get an announcement from the Secretary of State about the next tranche of funding.
What I'll agree with David on is one of the ways out to support proper planning and efficient organisation of local council services would be for us not just to see a one-off sticking plaster for COVID or indeed a one-year deal, a two-year deal to get us through this, but actually a longer-term settlement for local government. So we knew what resources we had going into the middle of the 2020s and be able to plan accordingly. David and I might disagree about that word fair, about what a fair distribution was, but both counties and big cities have the challenge around adult social care. And I think seeing council tax stretched further and further just to cover diminishing services has already caused a huge amount of frustration among residents. And I think any approach to local government that continues that will see that frustration continue for people who quite rightly expect good value for money from the council tax that they pay over.
Councillor James Lewis in Leeds and Councillor David Williams in Hertfordshire, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And that is all from us this week. A huge thanks to all of our guests, Sonia Soda, Patrick Wintour, David Williams and James Lewis. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourselves and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.